This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodl Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Our first question is from Gareth Toy, who asks via email, when are we going to have our first interstellar telescope? I'm sure we could get one there quicker than it has taken Voyager to reach the edge of the solar system. Maybe 10 years, perhaps?
Well, I think we're a long way off building an interstellar telescope, certainly a lot longer than 10 years. There's a few big advantages to putting telescopes in space. Firstly, it removes the distortion from the Earth's atmosphere. That's what caused the stars to twinkle. And that's why the Hubble Space Telescope has been able to produce such wonderful pictures. But it also allows us to look at wavelengths that which the Earth's atmosphere absorbs, like X-rays or infrared. Another big thing we can do is connect several smaller telescopes together to make one big virtual telescope. The bigger the telescope, the smaller the detail you can see. We call these virtual telescopes interferometers, and it's a technique we already use with radio telescopes like those at Jodrell Bank. Interferometers have become so large that we've run out of Earth to put them on. We've had to make radio telescopes in orbit to make our interferometers even bigger. But making a telescope bigger means it's hard to link together. You need a big grid of telescopes if you want to build an interferometer, otherwise you only end up being sensitive to things of a particular size or orientation. So unless you're going to send up a load of telescopes out in different directions at different speeds, building an interstellar interferometer is pretty much out. But what about a single interstellar telescope? Well, we can get things out beyond the solar system faster than Voyager. If you look at the New Horizons probe, which is now en route to Pluto, it's taken about 9 years to get there. But at this rate, it would still take 48,000 years even to reach the nearest stars. You then have the problem of how do you get the data back? Probes like Voyager and New Horizons require the biggest telescopes in NASA's deep space network to listen out for the distance signals. If you go much further than they are now, even the biggest telescopes won't hear them. Besides technical problems, assuming you're not going to build an interferometer, there's not really that much point in sending a telescope out into interstellar space anyway. Once you're out of the Earth's atmosphere, you've removed most of the distortion you can. And once you leave the solar system, space looks pretty much the same, black with shiny dots. The thing that most astronomers find interesting are so far away that even sending a telescope out of the solar system won't really bring you that much closer to them, so there's not really much point. So I think sending telescopes into interstellar space isn't going to happen anytime soon. The problems and cost are just too great, and we wouldn't get a whole lot more for it. Probes like the Voyagers are really only out there because they were going in that direction anyway. So if we're not going to build an interstellar space telescope, what we might see instead are observatories shielded from all the horrible pollution that people cause. Now, radio astronomers hate things like TV and radio signals and mobile phones and wireless routers. Their signals drown out the faint signals we're trying to receive from space. If you look at Jodrell Bank, even the microwave is stuck in a big cage to stop it from leaking radiation. One plan that we could implement is, say, put a telescope on the far side of the moon where it's shielded from the Earth. Now, this comes with its own sorts of problems, and it is not likely to happen for many years yet. But we can dream.
So the key difference here is the difference between a space probe and looking close in on astronomical objects and a space telescope. The telescopes want to look stuff far away anyway, and there's no benefit. But a space probe, putting that towards the edge of the solar system, like Voyager, that does have its benefits, I guess.
Sending a telescope that's looking at distant stars out of the solar system isn't going to bring you closer to them, at least not appreciably. But if you're going to get 50, 100, a million times closer to one of the planets that you're trying to look at, or an asteroid or a comet, something like that, then yes, it's going to be hugely advantage.
Awesome. I can't really like the idea of a telescope on the far side of the moon, though.
It's kind of cool, isn't it?
Little moon base. Our second question comes from Jeffrey, who's aged 9, so possibly our youngest Ask an Astronomer question yet. And he wants to know, what is the closest star to the Sun? Is it Alpha Centauri or Proxima Centauri?
It's a very good question, and depending on who you talk to, some people will say, after the Sun, the closest star is Alpha Centauri. Some people will say Proxima Centauri. I think the reason behind this is because Alpha Centauri, 4.3 light years away, is the closest star you can actually see in the night sky with your naked eye. Unfortunately, we can't see it in the UK, but if you're lucky enough to live in the Southern Hemisphere, you can see it from there. Alpha Centauri is actually two stars, bizarrely enough, Alpha Centauri A and B, which go around each other in an orbit of about 80 years. Because they're so close together, you can't see them with the naked eye separately, but a small telescope will show them as two separate stars. Alpha Centauri A is very much like the Sun, whereas Alpha Centauri B is a bit smaller and a bit redder. So what about Proxima Centauri? Well, it's a little closer than Alpha Centauri, 4.2 light years. It's quite a small star. It's only a seventh of the radius of the Sun, and it shines with a rather feeble 40 millionths of the light of Alpha Centauri. In fact, so faint that we can't see it without a telescope, despite its proximity. Now, Proxima Centauri is probably going around Alpha Centauri as well, which is why it sometimes also gets called Alpha Centauri C. If that's right, it would mean that all three stars are part of one system and all three orbit each other. Sometimes Alpha Centauri A will be the closest, sometimes B will be the closest, sometimes C will be. Now, all this means that poor old Proxima Centauri usually gets forgotten about. But for the next 20,000 years or so, Proxima Centauri will be the closest star to the Sun. At least the closest one that we know of. Now, here's a little bit of cutting-edge science you might like. A few weeks ago, astronomers found several planets floating freely in space, planets not going around the star. Now, they're a little bit too small to be called stars in their own right, and they probably look a bit like Jupiter. But if the calculations are right, that may mean there's more of these free-floating planets out there than there are stars. And that might mean there's one closer to the Sun than even Proxima Centauri. The thing is, it would shine so feebly that we couldn't see it even if we put our eye to the world's biggest telescope. They glow faintly in the infrared still, though, which means that special satellites with infrared telescopes on board might see them. One of these satellites, called WISE, is looking at the moment, and another, called Gaia, is being built. But unless one of these satellites finds a free-floating planet nearer to us, you can tell anyone who wants to know that the Sun's the closest star, Proxima Centauri is the second, Alpha Centauri A and B are the next two further away than that.
Wow. Triple system in orbiting, so that's going to change. Was it 20,000 years?
20,000 years.
20,000 years, so for the next 20,000 years, Proxima Centauri is the nearest star. Finally, our last question comes from Jod the Oak, and this is, I think, following on from a discussion we had a few Jodcasts ago about the supermoon possibly causing an earthquake in Japan, and how we were saying that's not really true. But the question is, if the moon pulls the Earth's crust and causes tides to flow, why couldn't the moon cause an earthquake?
Well, I've heard previously about the earthquakes supposedly being caused by phases of the lunar cycle or the super close moon or something like that. And some seismologists claim they'd found evidence of this back in the 1980s, but more accurate studies recently have found no link between the moon and earthquakes at all. I guess the best way to think about this is think how the moon could cause earthquakes. The moon's most noticeable effect on the Earth is through tides. The moon pulls at the Earth once every 24 hours and 50 minutes. If you're next to the sea, you might see this creating one or two tides a day, depending on where you are on Earth. But the gravitational pull of the moon on the Earth's surface is only very small. It's only a few millionths of the Earth's gravity. If we compare this to the forces acting on fault lines, even the smallest earthquake you can feel pulls at you with a force thousands of times bigger than this. Let's compare the pull of the moon to the forces acting on the fault lines. If you take the smallest earthquake you can feel, it pulls you with a few thousandths of the Earth's gravity. That means the forces pushing the rocks past each other are about a thousand times stronger than the gravitational pull of the moon. If you take a bigger earthquake, like the one that's happened recently in Japan, these forces can be a few million times stronger. So unless the puny tug from the moon is going to be the proverbial straw that broke the camel's back, it's not going to have that much of an effect. But just to check, I had a look at the aftershocks that happened in New Zealand and Japan after the recent earthquakes there. Between the two earthquakes, there's about 8,600 aftershocks. I compared their strength and the time they happened against the Earth's rotation, tidal periods, lunar cycle, everything else I could think of, and there just isn't any trend with any of them. So if tidal forces were going to cause earthquakes, what we'd actually need is a much bigger moon. Maybe a few thousand times bigger. Something like Jupiter, for example. It's about 26,000 times the mass of the moon, and pulls so strongly on its own moons that tidal friction heats up their insides. This heating causes volcanoes in Jupiter's closest moon, Io, and earthquakes in its second closest moon, Europa. Saturn and Neptune also heat up the moons in the same way, and you can see geysers coming off Enceladus and Triton, their two moons. So in summary, the moon doesn't cause earthquakes, because although the tides it creates are very obvious to us, the force it generates is just too puny to act in scales of matter for earthquakes. I think that rather puts into perspective the strength of the forces beneath your feet.
Wow, I'm just impressed at the length you went to go to answer that question for Jodie the Oak.
I'm nothing but dedicated.
That is some serious dedication going on. And thank you, Ian, for answering everyone's questions. I would also like to thank Gareth, Jeffrey, and Joe to the Oak for asking these questions. If anyone else wants to get in touch, you can do so via Ask an Astronomer on the website.